Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's useful to get some notebook, paper, and pen to take notes during the show. What we have been doing for some months now is exploring the myths about money. Our money system is not what we have been led to believe. The creation of money has been privatized or taken over by a private money cartel. Except for coins, all of our money is now created as loans advanced by private banking institutions, including the private Federal Reserve. Banks create the principal, but not the interest, to service their loans. To find the interest, new loans must continually be taken out, expanding the money supply, inflating prices, and robbing you of the value of your money. We've been specifically looking at a book called The Web of Debt, which unravels the deception and presents a clear picture of the financial abyss towards which we are heading. It then explores workable alternatives, particularly one that was tested in colonial America and is grounded in the best of American economic thought, including the writings of Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and Abraham Lincoln. It helps us to analyze and improve our own financial security, personally and nationally, and to deeply understand the cause of the problems we are personally experiencing financially. At the onset, I give an important credit because the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of attorney, scholar, and author Ellen Brown, who has 11 books and scores of articles on debt-related matters. I highly recommend her book, The Web of Debt. You should also visit her website by the same name. You could also go to www.kruufm.com under Archives to listen to all of the shows produced on this and other debt-related topics. This particular series is under Life and Debt Web. At the end of the last show, I ended talking about solving the impossible contract problem, which is really the question of interest. Like Andrew Jackson and Abraham Lincoln, Benjamin Franklin was a self-taught genius. He invented bifocals, the Franklin stove, the odometer, and the lightning rod. He was also called the father of paper money. He did not actually devise the banking system used in colonial Pennsylvania, but he wrote about it, promoted it, and understood its superiority over the debt-based private British system. When the directors of the Bank of England asked what was responsible for the booming economy of the young colonies, Franklin is reported to have said, quote, "That's simple. In the colonies, we issue our own money. It is called colonial scrip. We issue it to pay the government's approved expenses and charities. We make sure it is issued in proper proportions to make the goods pass easily from the producers to the consumers. In this manner, creating for ourselves our own paper money, we control its purchasing power, and we have no interest to pay to no one. You see, a legitimate government can both spend and lend money into circulation, while banks can only lend significant amounts of their promissory banknotes, for they can neither give away nor spend but a tiny fraction of the money the people need. Thus, when your bankers here in England place, money in circulation, there is always a debt principal to be returned and usury to be paid. The result is that you have always too little credit in circulation to give the workers full employment. You do not have too many workers, you have too little money in circulation, and that which circulates all bears the endless burden of unpayable debt and usury. End quote. That is what Franklin is reported to have said, but the words may have been put into his mouth later. Whoever said them, they are a succinct explanation of the advantages of the Pennsylvania banking system he favored over the British system. Since the provincial bank was a public institution, the profits returned to the local government rather than being siphoned off by external lenders. In an article titled "A Monetary System for the New Millennium," Canadian money reformer Roger Langrick explains the impossible contract problem in contemporary terms using an example in which $100 is lent at 10%. Quote, the result of creating 100 and demanding 110 in return is that the collective borrowers of a nation are forever chasing a phantom which can never be caught, the mythical $10 that was never created. The debt, in fact, is unrepayable. The only solution at present is increased borrowing to cover the principal plus the interest of what has been borrowed. Close quote. A better solution, Langrick says, would be to allow the government to issue enough new debt-free money to cover the interest charges not created by the banks as loans. Quote, instead of taxes, the government would be empowered to create money for its own expenses up to the balance of the debt shortfall. Thus, if the banking industry created $100 in a year, the government would create $10, which it would use for its own expenses. Abraham Lincoln used this successfully when he created $50 million of greenbacks to fight the Civil War. Close quote. In Langrick's example, a private banking industry pockets the interest, which must be replaced every year by a 10% issue of new greenbacks. But another alternative would be for the loans to be advanced by the government itself, as they were in colonial Pennsylvania. Principal and interest would then return to the government in a circular flow, making the system self-sustaining. Consider this hypothetical. We'll go back to the Wizard of Oz analogy. Let's say the Wicked Witch of the West rules over a dark fiefdom with a single private bank owned by the witch. The bank issues and lends all the money in the realm, charging an interest rate of 10%. The witch prints 100 witch dollars, lends them to her constituents, and demands 110 back. The people don't have the extra $10, so the witch creates 10 more on her books and lends them as well. The money supply must continually increase to cover the interest, which winds up in the witch's private coffers. She gets progressively richer as the people slip further into debt. She uses her accumulated profits to buy things she wants. She is particularly fond of little thatched houses and shops, of which she has an increasingly large collection. To fund the operations of her fiefdom, she taxes the people heavily, adding to their financial burdens. Glinda, the good witch of the South, runs her realm in a more people-friendly way. All of the money in the land is issued and lent by a people's bank, operated for their benefit. She begins by creating 110 people's dollars. She lends 100 of these dollars at 10% interest and spends the extra $10 into the community on programs designed to improve the general welfare, things such as pensions for retirees, social services, infrastructure, education, research, and development. The $110 circulates in the community and comes back to the People's Bank as principal and interest on its loans. Glinda again lends $100 of this money into the community and spends the other $10 on public programs, supplying the interest for the next round of loans while providing the people with jobs and benefits. For many years, she just recycles the same $110 without creating new money. Then one year, a cyclone comes up that destroys many of the charming little thatched houses. The people ask for their extra money to rebuild. No problem, says Glinda. She will just print more people's dollars and use them to pay for the necessary labor and materials. Inflation is avoided because supply increases along with demand. Best of all, taxes are unknown in the realm. If you are just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now, coming back to Glinda, it sounds good in a fairy tale in a land with a benevolent queen and only one bank, but things are quite a bit different in the real world. For one thing, enlightened, benevolent leaders are hard to come by. For another thing, returning all the interest collected on loans to the government would require nationalizing not only the whole banking system, but every other form of private lending at interest, an alternative that is a bit radical for current Western thinking. A more realistic model would be a dual lending system, semi-private and semi-public. The government would be the initial issuer and lender of funds, and private financial institutions would recycle this money as loans. Private lenders would still be siphoning interest into their own coffers, just not as much. The money supply would therefore still need to expand to cover interest charges, just not by as much. The actual amount it would need to expand and how this could be done without triggering dangerous price inflations will be discussed in later shows. Instituting a system of government-owned banks may sound radical in the United States, but some countries have already done it, and some other countries are ripe for radical reform. Rodney Shakespeare, author of The Modern Universal Paradigm in 2007, suggests that significant monetary reform may come first in the Islamic community. Islamic reformers are keenly aware of the limitations of the current Western system and are actively seeking change, and oil-rich Islamic countries may have the clout to pull it off. As discussed earlier, Western lenders got around the religious proscription against usury, taking a fee for the use of money, by redefining the term to mean taking excessive interest, but Islamic purists still hold to the older interpretation. The Islamic Republic of Iran has a state-owned central bank and has assumed a lead role in adopting the principles of the Quran as state government policy, including interest-free lending. In September of 2007, Iran's president advocated returning to an interest-free system and appointed a new central bank governor who would further these objectives. The governor said that banks should generate income by charging fees for their services rather than making a profit by receiving interest on loans. Indeed, that might have been one covert factor in the persistent drumbeats for war against Iran. Despite a December 2007 national intelligence estimate finding that the country was not developing nuclear weapons, the asserted justification for a very aggressive stance against it. A paper titled Rebuilding America's Defenses, released in September 2000 by a politically influential neoconservative think tank called the Project for the New American Century, linked America's national defense to suppressing economic rivals. The policy goal it urged included ensuring economic domination of the world while strangling any potential rival or viable alternative to America's vision of a free market economy. We've seen that alternative models threaten the dominance of the prevailing financial establishment have consistently been targeted for takedown, either by speculative attack, economic sanctions, or war. Iran has repeatedly been hit with economic sanctions that could strangle its economy. While the threat of a viable interest-free banking system could be a covert factor in the war posturing against Iran, today that banking threat remains largely hypothetical. Islamic banks typically charge fees on loans that are little different from interest. A common arrangement is to finance real estate purchases by buying property and selling it to clients at a higher price to be paid in installments over time. Skeptical Islamic scholars maintain that these arrangements merely amount to interest-bearing loans by other names. They use terms such as the usury of deception and the jurisprudence of legal tricks. One problem for banks attempting to follow an interest-free model is that they are normally private institutions that have to compete with other private banks. They have little incentive to engage in commercial lending if they are taking risks without earning a corresponding profit. However, Sweden and Denmark have interest-free savings and loan associations that have been operating successfully for decades. These institutions are cooperatively owned and are not designed to return a profit to their owners. They merely provide a service, facilitating borrowing and lending among their members. Costs are covered by service charges and fees. Interest-free lending would be particularly feasible if it were done by banks owned by a government with the power to create money. Like in China, a government that did not need to worry about carrying a $10 trillion+ federal debt could afford to carry a few private bad debts on its books without upsetting the economy. A publicly owned bank providing interest-free credit would just be a credit clearing agency, an intermediary that allowed people money to monetize their own promises to repay. As in a community currency system, people would become sovereign issuers of their own money, not just collectively, but individually. That's what happened actually today when purchases are made with a credit card. Your signature turns the credit slip into a negotiable instrument, which the merchant accepts because the credit card company stands behind it and will pursue legal remedies if you don't pay. But the bank doesn't actually lend you anything. It just facilitates and guarantees the deal. You create the money yourself, and if you pay your bill in full every month, you are creating money interest-free. Credit could be extended interest-free for longer periods on the same model. To assure that advances of the national credit got repaid, national banks would have the same remedies lenders have now, including foreclosure on real estate and other collateral, garnishment of wages, and the threat of a bad credit rating for defaulters, while borrowers would still have the safety net of filing for bankruptcy if they could not pay. They would just have an easier time meeting their obligations, since their interest-free loans would be far less onerous than the credit card charges of 18, 20, and 30% or more of today's market. So what are the pros and cons of interest? Interest charges are incorporated into every stage of producing a product, from pulling new raw materials out of the earth to putting the goods on store shelves. These cumulative charges have been estimated to compose about half the cost of every public project. That means that if interest charges were eliminated, prices might be slashed in half. Interest-free loans would be particularly appropriate for funding state and local infrastructure projects. Among other happy results, taxes could be reduced. Infrastructure and sustainable energy development might pay for themselves. Affordable housing for everyone would be a real possibility, and the inflation resulting from the spiral of ever-increasing debt might be eliminated. And I'll return to this in a moment. If you are just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now back to interest. On the downside, interest-free loans could create another massive housing bubble if not properly monitored. The current housing bubble resulted when monthly housing payments were artificially lowered to the point where nearly anyone could get a mortgage, regardless of the assets. This problem could be avoided by reinstating substantial down payment and income requirements and by shortening payout periods. A home that formerly cost $3,000 per month would still cost $3,000 per month. The mortgage would just be shorter. Another hazard of unregulated interest-free lending is that it could produce the sort of speculative carry trade that developed in Japan after it made interest-free or nearly interest-free loans available to all. Investors borrowing at zero or very low interest used the money to buy bonds paying higher interest, pocketing the difference, and these trades were often highly leveraged, inflating the money supply and magnifying risk. As the dollar lost value relative to the yen, investors had to scramble to repay their yen loans in an increasingly illiquid credit market, forcing them to sell other assets and contributing to systemic market failure. One solution to this problem might be a version of real bills doctrine. Interest-free credit would be available only for real things traded in the economy. No speculation, investing on margin, or shorting. What would prudent savers rely on for their retirement years if interest were eliminated from the financial scheme? As in Islamic and Old English systems, money would still be invested for profit. It would just need to be done as profit sharing, sharing not only in the profits but in the losses. In a compound interest arrangement, the lender gets his interest no matter what. In fact, he does better if the borrower fails, since the strapped borrower provides him with a steady income stream at higher rates of interest than otherwise. In today's market, profit sharing basically means that savers would move their money out of bonds and into stocks. Alternatives for taking the risk out of retirement will be explored in later shows. So now let's move on to the next concept, a financial system in which bankers are public servants. The religious objection to charging interest is that people who have not labored for the money take it from those who have earned it by the sweat of their brows. This result could be avoided, however, without actually banning interest. In ancient Sumer, interest was collected but went to the temple, which then dispersed it to the community for the common good. A similar model was created by Muhammad Yunus, the Muslim professor who funded the Grameen Bank of Bangladesh. The Grameen Bank charges interest, but at a significantly lower rate than would otherwise be available to poor women lacking collateral. And the interest is returned to the bank for their benefit as its shareholders. That was also the system successfully employed in colonial Pennsylvania, where a public land bank collected interest and returned it to the provincial government to be issued in place of taxes. Whether loans are extended interest-free or interest is returned to the community, community-oriented models would work best if the banks were publicly owned institutions that did not need to return a profit. Today, government-owned banks are associated with socialism, something that has negative connotations in the United States, but they would not have raised the eyebrows of our forefathers. The Pennsylvania Land Bank was a provincially owned institution that generated sufficient profits to fund the local government without taxes. And in this, it was quite different from the modern socialist scheme. Even the most successful modern Western democratic socialist countries, including Sweden and Australia, do not eliminate taxes. Rather than funding their governments with profits from publicly owned ventures, they rely on heavy taxes imposed on the private sector. Sweden developed one of the largest welfare states in Europe after 1945, but it had few government-run industries. India was off to a good start, but it got sucked into massive foreign debt by the engineered oil crisis of 1974 and a banker-manipulated Congress that took an unnecessary IMF debt. The Australian Labor Party, while holding public ownership of infrastructure out as an ideal, has not had enough political power to put that ideal into practice, at least not lately. At the turn of the 20th century, Australia did have a very successful publicly owned bank, one of which Ben Franklin would have approved. Australia's Commonwealth Bank was a people's bank that not only issued paper money, but made loans and collected interest on them. Its profits were paid to the national government. When private banks were demanding 6% interest, Commonwealth Bank financed the Australian government's first World War effort at an interest rate of a fraction of 1%. The result was to save Australians some $12 million in bank charges. After the First World War, the bank's governor used the bank's credit power to minimize the effects of the depression suffered in other countries. The bank financed production and home building and lent funds to local governments for the construction of roads, tramways, harbors, gas works, and electric power plants. Australia's massive Snowy River Hydro scheme was funded without debt simply by drawing on the national credit card. Later in the century, however, the bank fell into the 20th century global drive for privatization, prompted by the International Monetary Fund and the World Trade Organization. Early in the 20th century, Australia had a living standard that was among the highest in the world. But after its bank was privatized, the country fell heavily into debt. By the end of the century, its standard of living had dropped to 23rd. New Zealand in the 1930s and 1940s also had a government-owned central bank that successfully funded public projects, keeping the economy robust when the rest of the world was languishing in depression. Canada achieved this as well. The Bank of Canada became publicly owned in 1938 and successfully funded the government for nearly 40 years after that, including funding the Canadian single-payer healthcare system. The province of Alberta, Canada, has also had publicly owned banks since 1938, which have served to provide ready credit for the local economy. In the United States during the Great Depression, Franklin Roosevelt reshaped the U.S. Reconstruction Finance Corporation, the RFC, into a source of cheap and abundant credit for developing the national infrastructure and putting the country back to work. Other ventures in U.S. government banking have included the U.S. Postal Savings System, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and the Small Business Administration, which oversees loans to small businesses that might otherwise be denied credit because the loans are not profitable enough to warrant the risks. Public banks are actually no more socialist than public post offices, public libraries, and public courts. All money today, except coins, originates as credit or debt, and credit is merely a legal agreement to repay over time. Just as we would not want our legal agreements overseen by private judges available for hire by the highest bidder, so we do not need to have our agreements to repay credit overseen by private bankers. But the common objection to getting the government involved in business is that it is notoriously inefficient at those pursuits. Betty Reed Mandel, author of Selling Uncle Sam, maintains that this reputation is undeserved. She points out that the only enterprises left to government are those from which private enterprise cannot make a profit. Surveys show that in-house operation of publicly provided services is generally more efficient than contracting them out, while privatizing public infrastructure for private profit has typically led to increased costs, inefficiency, and corruption. A case in point is the deregulation and privatization of electricity in California, which met with heavy criticism as an economic disaster for the state. Complex publicly provided services tend to break down with privatization just from the complexity of contracting and supervising the contract. Privatization of the British rail system caused rate increases, rail accidents, and system breakdown to the point that a majority of the British public now favors returning to government ownership and operation. And we will continue this in the next show. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.